This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Donald Trump is more vulnerable than ever.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. This is our weekly roundup, where we invite a rotating panel of experts to discuss the truth you need to know behind the most important stories of the week and how they're shaping the political landscape. We have an outstanding panel of Politicology veterans. Al Cardenas. Al is a nationally recognized Cuban-American leader in law, business, and politics who served in the Reagan and H.W. Bush administrations. He's been recognized as one of the most influential people in Florida politics, and he's a former chair of the American Conservative Union and a two-term chairman of the Republican Party of Florida. Al, always great to see you. Welcome back to Politicology.
It's great to be with you. I always enjoy it. Thank you.
We also have Hagar Shamali, who is a former spokesperson for the U.S. mission to the U.N. and at the Treasury's Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. She was also a Middle East director at the National Security Council in the Obama White House and is now an adjunct professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, and the host and creator of Oh My World on YouTube, a show that breaks down geopolitics and world news stories in a fun and easy way. Hagar, thanks for being here again.
So happy to be here, Ron. Thanks for having me.
Up first this week, Trump is now a meme stock. DJT takes his social media company public at a truly crazy valuation. We'll talk about what the ticker price shows about his support and the more serious dangers it presents, whether he gets into the White House or not. Then we'll talk about the terrorist attack in Moscow, Putin blaming Ukraine, and what the current conflicts between major military powers means for terrorist organizations, and whether ISIS is once again on the rise. After that, we'll discuss why you're not crazy for thinking inflation was worse than economists and politicians told you, and whether Joe Biden should try to pressure the Federal Reserve Bank. Then we will find out what other political developments Hagar and Al are paying attention to and why. Finally, in a separate episode just for Politicology Plus members, we are going to talk about the on-air uproar over former RNC chair Ronna McDaniel's hiring at NBC News, her lightning-fast termination, and the broader challenge of achieving ideological balance in media when most Republicans believe a provable lie. If you are a Politicology Plus member, thank you. Politicology would not exist if it weren't for you. And if you are not yet a member and you want to join us for that episode, go to politicology.com/plus to access all of those hidden episodes without any ads and join an informed and thoughtful community of pro-democracy listeners who help keep the show going. To level up right now, go to politicology.com/plus or click the link in your show notes.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Truth Social. Trump is facing huge legal bills. We're looking at where he's getting the money to pay them. There was a significant ruling on Monday, which is that Trump only has to post about a $170 million bond to appeal the civil fraud judgment against him. That's down from nearly half a billion. The judge also gave him 10 additional days to come up with the money. It also puts off the prospect of the New York Attorney General seizing his assets for now. But he still has to come up with the money. And far more interesting than the $60 God Bless America Bibles he's now shilling is that he just took Truth Social public. It started trading on Tuesday under the ticker DJT and ended the day with an $8 billion market valuation, which is on par with companies like Lyft and Etsy. As of right now, it's around a $6 billion market cap. It's worth noting that there is a six-month lockup period, meaning that it's not super liquid and he's supposed to wait 6 months before accessing the funds, but his hand-picked board could just waive that lockup period for him. Or if he finds a bank dumb enough, he could borrow against the extremely volatile stock. Truth Social has about 5 million monthly active users. Pinterest had about 50 times that, 250 million monthly active users when it went public in 2019, but had a market cap of less than twice his. Jason Calacanis, who I follow on Twitter, a well-known successful investor in early stage tech firms, tweeted with a giant laughing emoji, "If you wanted to give DJT a valuation at a seed / series A level with $3 million in yearly revenue, it would be worth 25 to 50x top line at max, so $75 to $150 million if it was 3xing revenue year over year. This is the biggest pump and dump stock in history, and I could see it going higher from here. I predict 1 million plus Trump supporters might buy $1,000 plus each just to show support while playing the pump and dump game." The largest institutional investor in the company that merged with Truth Social is run by Jeffrey Yass. We talked about Jeffrey Yass last week. He has a 15% stake in ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok. He's a Trump donor, and Trump met with him before he flip-flopped on TikTok. So, how are you thinking, Al, about the potential avenue this creates to influence a presidential candidate and possible president?
Well, actually, you know, this is a great course study. If you're taking a master's or PhD in one of our finest educational institutions, because it's a story and a history on cash flow, right? You know, you've got all the limitations, 6 months limitation. There could very well be a limitation on pledging the stock in this SPAC. SPACs are well known for having failed miserably and having some shenanigans going on. Whether the Trump investment will escape that scrutiny or not, we won't really find out for 6 months. My sense is that the value of the stock will significantly decrease, but it'll take a significant dump 6 months from now. And, you know, you don't have a lot of sophisticated investors who put any money on this stock. The valuation that you just read is the one that I'm familiar with and consider accurate. I mean, I thought this was like a $100 million business, not a $5 billion business or $8 billion business. And so if he can't pledge this stock, it won't serve for the purposes of a bond. It could incentivize some folks into thinking that regardless, he's going to come into some significant money and view the risk of giving him bond money differently. But I don't know the answer to that. I do know that he's going to be, you know, scrapped for cash until that event happens. Most of his holdings are held in partnerships with other people who are not willing to divest their interest at this time and sell it for, you know, pennies or the dollar or a reduced amount. And so there are very few assets that he actually owns by himself. And so it's a true cash flow study of how does he survive until the six-month expiration period of the SPAC, and what's his interest in the SPAC worth at that time after the depreciation takes place.
So, Hagar, the thing that I'm most curious about is what we know about what opportunities this might present for foreign actors to funnel money to Trump sort of indirectly through a publicly traded vehicle that he controls. It'd be much harder for them to get money into legal campaign entities of any kind. But on the public market, foreign actors, whether they be states or sovereigns or private investors, can dump all kinds of capital into U.S. capital markets, including publicly traded companies. So how are you thinking about this as a vector for foreign influence?
Right. And I think, you know, you've hit an interesting point, because Trump and the Trump family in general have proven themselves to be very exposed to foreign influence and foreign investment. And they have not cared. These are things that are not, it's not illegal for them to have these kind of business dealings, but they are typically conflicts of interest. When I was at the White House, it really showed how weak the ethics structure is in government. When I was in government, and particularly at the White House, you have to sign all sorts of documents about ethics. You have ethics training, you have obviously financial disclosure forms and so on. And you're kind of just instilled with this idea that if you don't follow the ethics rules, And the ethics rules are pretty clear on conflicts of interest and financial conflicts of interest. But then if you don't follow them, nobody really asks what happens to you. You just assume that you're going to either lose your job or you're going to lose your security clearance. And so it's self-regulating. And as a result, everybody in general, the majority follow the rules. And when Donald Trump and his family came to the White House, they upended all of that, which is risky for many reasons, because it erodes a system of self-regulation that was there for a reason. And it highlighted to people that actually the incentive to follow these rules is not really there if you're not going to lose your job or you're not going to lose your security clearance. Now, that could change based on different administrations, but he really exposed that reality. And so you're seeing multiple avenues where foreign investors, foreign influence could appear. This is one of them. And that is the first thing a foreign actor is going to do. And most foreign actors, because they don't have the same rules that we do, especially when you're talking about governments like, let's say, the Emirati government, the Turkish government, the Azerbaijani government, these are governments where they are friendly with the United States. They are partners of the United States in some way, shape, or form, but they are also authoritarian, or they have ugly sides to them and so on. And they have interests in the United States, and they spend a lot of money, for example, on lobbying in Washington. And so if they see an opportunity to somehow get money to a candidate or a campaign, by the way, and to do it in a way that is in this way, it would be perfectly legal for them to invest in Truth Social, to buy shares of Truth Social, obviously. Even you wonder to what stake could they have? How much of a stake could they have in Truth Social? It becomes not only risky because you certainly don't want any foreign actor, as we're seeing with TikTok, as you noted, having influence over a social media platform. But for Trump, that could be a gift. It is a way of giving him money. It is a way of getting on his good side. It is a way of effectively lobbying him. He's not going to want to pursue, if it's, let's pretend, the UAE, Turkey, or Azerbaijan, he's not going to want to pursue anything tough with them if he knows that they're an investor in a social media platform that he has already proven that by getting to the presidency, he doesn't have to unload himself of these companies he's invested in or owns. And so it presents a significant vulnerability and liability. But had you asked me this question in 2015, I would have told you, oh yeah, no, but of course there's no way he'll be able to worry continue about it, owning course. This.
Yeah.
Right. And now I just don't believe that anymore because he's already disproven that.
Now, Ron, two caveats to that.
Yeah.
Number one, remember the 6-month period expires in September, 2 months before the election. And that's when I think, Hager, a lot of action is going to be taking place in terms of the stock itself and the restrictions being removed. Number two, you know, SPAC is a public company. And so there are requirements for a public company to make disclosures. And those disclosures will have to include new significant investors. And so people will know in America that foreign governments or foreign entities have invested in this SPAC before the election. And so there's a risk involved in that it's not something that can be kept secret if it's an investment in the SPAC. And if it's an investment in a PAC, political PAC, then there are all kinds of political risks and legal risks involved. And so it's interesting. I agree with Hager about Trump's attitude about this. And I agree with her about, you know, if it looks like Trump might be a winner in September or earlier, some of these countries may obviously want to take a stake in the friendship side with Trump. But, you know, there are risks involved for everybody.
Do you guys think that his board, so this 6-month lockup period that we're talking about, which ends in September, as you mentioned, that's not a legal requirement. It's a contractual requirement that he has agreed to with his board, and he could persuade the board to waive that and let him out of it and do it sooner. Do you think that's likely?
Well, from my standpoint, you know, as a lawyer, these are thousands of people with very little recourse. And my sense is that trial lawyers are going to be salivating when this stock is dumped. And so if I was a board member, I'd better have good board DNA insurance, because there are a lot of suits that are going to be coming towards the board and the governance of Truth Social when the stock prices go where I think they're going to go.
Oh, that's a good point. Okay, last question on this. What do you guys make of the fact that the largest institutional investor in Truth Social also has a major stake in TikTok's parent company? Hagar?
Yeah, this was, I'm so glad you mentioned this, because we already saw Trump flip-flop, just to walk it back a little bit. We already saw Trump flip-flop on his views on TikTok. As we all know, the House passed this bill to ban TikTok if it doesn't sell within 6 months of the bill's enactment. It's over at the Senate now. We don't know what's going to happen at the Senate. President Biden has implied that, has said that he would sign this bill if it came to his desk. And Donald Trump, who was the first person to actually propose banning TikTok while he was president, said that he's against the bill. And his flip-flop is not about the national security threats tied to TikTok that he himself propagated and pushed out there and really introduced, actually. It's entirely about investment and the fact that he's got somebody, one of his biggest investors, who is tied to ByteDance. And by the way, it's not just that. It's that Donald Trump is more vulnerable than ever when it comes to his financial situation and his financial worth. And you're seeing that play out in the public with all of his everything he owes right now, and his inability to try and to reach the hundreds of millions of dollars that he owes. And every day now, I feel like we're seeing some kind of new product rollout. First, it was a sneaker, that, you know, now it's a Bible. You know, and he listened, and I wish I could say that. I think I said this last time, that the joke is on us, because he rolls these products out and is successful at selling them. And every time there's a new criminal case of some kind or indictment, it feels like his base donates. Now, if you compare, and we could talk about this later, if you compare to Biden and the DNC and the Democrat campaign, the Republicans are behind, way behind on this. But that being said, it's even more of a vulnerability. And so he's going to be even more incentivized. Not that I had much hope that he separated conflicts of interest before, but now he's even more incentivized to do whatever it takes to grow his financial worth, to raise funds, and to protect anybody who invests with him. And that will extend to protecting those who are foreign who invest in him, or those Americans who have investments that are dubious of some kind or questionable, or in the case of TikTok, pose real national security threats. And I would expect, I just don't think this is going to be the first we're going to see of this.
Let's talk about the Moscow attack and what it means for the global order, the tension between the U.S. and Russia. Last Friday, gunmen busted into a concert hall on the outskirts of Moscow. At least four people opened fire. The attack lasted about 20 minutes. At least 137 people were killed. At least 60 others were wounded. The Afghanistan branch of ISIS, called ISIS-K, claimed responsibility for the attack. The U.S. and France are both saying the attack was carried out by ISIS. Putin has claimed that Ukraine is behind the attack, but has acknowledged the shooters were radical Islamists. Ukraine has denied any involvement, of course. 2 weeks before the attack, the U.S. warned Putin's government that there were imminent plans for an attack in Russia, and Putin condemned those warnings as provocative statements from the West. Okay, Hagar, Russia didn't act on U.S. intelligence. What opportunities does the current tension between the U.S. and Russia, and China, we should say, create for non-state actors like ISIS-K?
What a shame they didn't act on that, by the way. The U.S. intelligence community is very proud. The U.S. government, too, is very proud of having a duty to warn, because, and I always say this, that, you know, people don't really understand sometimes how good the U.S. government is. People like to hate on the U.S. government. Apparently now Americans too, but like Americans, people around the world, they love to hate on the U.S. government. And it is such a good, we do so many good things. And that was an example of that. No matter if it's an adversary, it doesn't matter. When we see something that poses a threat to innocent civilians, and we have the it's the fact that we have this intelligence, that we're good at this. The U.S. government, I mean, we feel a responsibility to share that information to protect innocent civilians. And that is what the U.S. government did, which is standard practice. And the fact that the Russian government reacted this way is horrifying, because they threw their own civilians under the bus. This is something that should have been prevented. That said, when you have attacks of this kind start to grow, and this is the same group, for example, that did the attack a couple months ago in Iran that killed something like over 80 people. And Iran, by the way, at first, remember, they first tried to blame the US and Israel, and then they kind of quickly got silent about it. They seemed to accept that, okay, this was ISIS, and let go of the US-Israel scapegoat. This is the same group that pursued that massive attack when the Taliban took over, and when the Afghanistan government fell, and that you had that massive attack in the chaos of that week, and you had one at the airport. That's the same group that did this. It's ISIS, but it's a specific group of ISIS, ISIS-K, as you said. And these terrorist groups, on one hand, ISIS-K has Russia as a target because they blame Putin, or they accuse him, they view him as having Muslim blood on his hands for Russia's involvement in the war in Syria. And Russia got involved in the war in Syria in 2014. In fact, President Assad of Syria would have lost that war had it not been for Russia's involvement. They went in with their planes and bombs and so on, and did massive bombing campaigns. And they claimed it was to go after ISIS. And in some cases, it was after ISIS, but in other cases, it was after Syrian oppositionists and the Free Syrian Army and so on. But anyway, so Russia and Putin particularly have been always on ISIS-K's target list because of their involvement in Syria. And so you have that on one hand. And then on the other, they pursue attacks when either there's chaos in general, you know, just instability, and that's what explained the attack that happened in Iran a couple months ago, and or they pursue attacks when they see that a country has let their guard down and is distracted by something else. Because that, when you have, and this is a perfect example of that, you have Russia being distracted, Russia's security apparatus being distracted by the war in Ukraine and being very heavily focused on repressing its own citizens. In fact, 1 hour before this terrorist attack happened, and I don't think this was timed, I think this just highlights my point. 1 hour before this attack happened, the Russian regime labeled those in the quote LGBT movement as terrorists and extremists. And so just to highlight to you what the security apparatus is focused on repressing its own citizens and dissidents and those of the LGBTQ+ community, rather than an actual threat, a threat that was given to them in advance. And so this is on the Russian government. But the fact is, when you have situations like this, that's what allows these terrorist groups to pursue attacks like that. And it could be anywhere. I don't want to be, you know, doom and gloom here, but if you've got a government, any government that's on their target list where they see, they're focused on Ukraine, they're focused on their people. Interesting. The U.S. has a border that's, you know, porous that we could try and take advantage of. They take advantage of those vulnerabilities. They watch that very closely. And that's when you see attacks of this kind.
Okay. Al, I want to look domestically now, because I want to talk about who this helps and who this hurts, because Trump went on a victory tour claiming that he defeated ISIS, and now they're carrying out attacks and the threat level is rising. But Biden's the president now, while there are wars breaking out left and right, and the terror threat is now on the rise. How do you think the increase in these terrorist attacks plays domestically in the United States? Biden is now, for all intents and purposes, a wartime president, even though the United States is not directly at war. How do you think this plays?
Well, you know, if you had asked me 5 years ago, I would have said we would have reacted differently. But the onslaught of domestic terrorist attacks, I think, have gotten us to consider terrorist attacks as a norm rather than as abstraction, that's not something that's part of the U.S. You know, we're separated by two oceans. Our soil has never been involved in a world war. We've never had massive casualties like all of Europe and Russia and China. And so we're, you know, our people are mostly, in my opinion, oblivious to the dangers of global crisis at this level. And I'm biased, obviously, because, you know, my family fled Cuba in large part. We consider Russia a primary reason why we fled. And half of me is Lebanese, and I consider Iran, you know, a big spoiler in what's going on in Lebanon with Hezbollah and some other stuff. So, you know, I have a very poor view of Iran and Russia, and I have a very realistic view, I think, of the global crisis they represent. They both pride themselves on the fact that they're so good at having total control of their countries that nothing that's happening around the world and in the U.S. can happen in their soil. And so when Russia had this terrorist attack, and when that happened in Iran, in my opinion, that kind of shook them because it embarrassed greatly those folks who run those countries who pride themselves in not having any of that insurrection happen, how quickly they squashed dissent, how quickly they killed people who are responsible for dissent. And here this happens, and they have to live with this. And then they start pointing fingers that really lead to nowhere because they're not accurate. And so I think what's happened to them is a result that, hey, not even you bloody authoritarian government can really escape the terrorist craziness that's going on. We've bred barbarians around the world, and those barbarians are on the loose, and they like being barbarians. And so it wasn't hard for ISIS to recruit people in Afghanistan, especially. It's not terribly difficult for terrorists to, you know, for Hamas and Hezbollah and others to recruit people. We have recruited barbarians now all over the place, and they like the action. They like being barbarians. They like to, you know, they like to rape. They like to pimp. It's like the Vikings of old. And these people are roaming around the world because they're happy to affiliate with institutions or entities that, A, give them something to eat, and B, allows them to be barbarians. And sadly, that's the state of human affairs now.
So I just thought of this. I'll be digging into this question with Molly McHugh, who's my favorite Russia, Ukraine person to talk to. But one thing that Molly and I have talked about a lot, and Mike Madrid and I have talked about a lot, is the open question that comes up a lot when we talk about U.S. involvement in other countries and the sort of aversion to U.S. intervention in other places, both on the left and on the right, on the far left and on the far right, for different reasons. But, you know, horseshoe theory, they end up in the same place, which is that they don't want any more U.S. involvement in the world. It's an isolationist fringe on both sides of the party, both sides of the aisle. And so the question that comes up is oftentimes, what is the case for America to be involved in the rest of the world? And in order to answer that question, you have to sort of articulate what it means to be America. What is America now? What does it mean to be an American now? And every time I look at this, I see a wide open lane for a gifted politician to make a compelling case to America for American leadership in the world and what that means now and why we need it now in a way that's salient for people where they are now. And I just realized, I didn't know this, Al, that you were half Lebanese. Hagar is half Lebanese. Half Lebanese, Hagar? Yes?
Both my parents are Lebanese. I'm born here, though. Yeah, I'm American of Lebanese descent. I like to joke that that everyone is Lebanese. And Al, you just proved my point. And it, yeah. And Ronald, you're probably, you know, Ronald somewhere.
Somewhere, yes.
Yeah, because Lebanese have spread out so much across around the world that they intermarry and so on. And everyone can always find some Lebanese in there somewhere. Yeah. So
Al, you are first generation American. Yes. And great. Hagar, second or third?
I believe, yes. Second is when you're born here and your parents came. Yes.
Correct. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right.
And so I wonder if both of you could share, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but if you were to articulate what it means to be an American to Americans now, what words would you put in Joe Biden's mouth? Imagine he's a gifted orator. What case would you make for A, why why American leadership is important at this time in world history and what it means to you to be an American. Because I think that especially now, the perspective of people who've come to this country more recently than others is has a lot to teach our country.
I'm very excited about this question. I just hope I don't talk too long. I'll make sure to be brief. Ron, you so eloquently summed this up and highlighted something that is, I don't know if you've noticed, but there have been a lot of either first or second generation Americans who continue beating this drum of how, feeling the need to remind the broader US and broader American public, and in particular, I've noticed a younger American public, how lucky they are, how amazing this country is, that it is the best country in the world. And that's how I was raised. My parents fled civil war. My dad was kidnapped, brutally beaten, released on the condition that he leave and never return. And they left Lebanon. They toured the world for 3 months, had landed in Connecticut and visiting friends, had decided on moving to Italy, but because of a complication with my mom's pregnancy, me, they stayed in Connecticut. So I like to say that I chose living here. And my dad, of course, wanted to stay in New York, really was, you know, lived the American dream. Had his first business, it failed, learned all the lessons and did a new one. And that one was quite successful. And they raised me telling me every day how that I was American, that I was never to look back, that I had no reason to look back, to learn Arabic, to learn, to know. I mean, and then they are literally, I mean, they left civil war, so they're a little self-hating, if you will, but they told me how lucky I was to be born here, that I could do anything I wanted to do, that I could say anything I wanted to say and be whomever I wanted to be, and raised me that way. And I have no doubt that that's what inspired me to go into the US government, because I felt so strongly about serving. And I met so many other people like me, just replace the country, right? Where they were from another country. But 9 out of 10 times, they were from countries that their parents had fled because of conflict or dictatorship or repression or injustices and persecution and so on. And the US government is made up of so many people like that, as is everywhere. Obviously, all of us are immigrants at some point and have contributed so deeply to the fabric of the United States. And but as you see, especially since divisions have grown and you see kind of this hatred a little bit toward the US government, you see many people, some famous, really famous activists like Enes Kanter Freedom, who's Turkish American, and Yeonmi Park, who's North Korean American now. And I don't agree with everything. She's a little bit right-wing for me, but they come out, they continue to repeat to people, don't you understand how lucky you are that in any other country, you keep saying that the US is not the best country, but if you went anywhere else, you would be repressed for saying the things you said. You'd be jailed, you'd be killed, you know, and so on. And the thing that, so this is to sum up my experience and why I feel so deeply about the United States, why I love my country so much, and why I feel so deeply about serving it and bettering it. That said, when to answer your question about what I feel, and I want to go back, I want to make sure because I gave you this long anecdote. Your question is what it means to be American. And it's so difficult to sum up, but if I were to, it means opportunity. And it means that you have the ability to pursue that opportunity and that you're not going to face either the inability of pursuing it because of your background or religion or race, that you have laws in place to ensure that. You're not going to have to pay someone off to get that opportunity. And I'm not trying to pretend like it's perfect. I'm not, you know, I understand that we have inequalities here and we're, you know, a lot to work on. We are a work in progress, but that is also what it means to be American, that we have a system that allows us to work to perfect it and to better it for a more perfect union. So I'm going to end there because I feel like I could get really inspirational here and do like an hour discussion on this, but that's to sum up my feelings about this.
I'm glad I asked.
Over to you, Al.
Yeah, Al, bring it on.
Thank you. Well, listen, I've been a life witness to suffering, disenchantment, fear. Imagine the Lebanese side of my family. For a civil war, they migrated to Cuba. And arriving in Cuba with practically nothing, they built a pretty darn good business and quasi-empire, only to lose it all again a second time. Imagine having to, one was for religious wars, and the other one was for communism, but losing everything you've worked for all your life twice. And I being a witness to what happened to that side of my family. The other side of my family, my dad, they were in Cuba in the 1800s when civil war ensued and Cuba became independent. They too had built a good life and they too lost everything. And so I am the child of a family who lost everything because of government government trashing all of the rights that one should expect to have. And so when I came to America, I fell in love with this country. I came to America at the age of 12. I was probably the only guy in my high school who would read, you know, who would, and I say guy because it was an old guy school, the Catholic Church helped help my family get there. But I was reading the front page of the papers when I was in high school, just so absorbed with what was going on around the world. And, you know, started in politics when I was in college and never stopped being interested just because of a deep, you know, of a deep hurt, of a deep understanding of what unfair governments can do, which is why, frankly, at this day, I am, for the very first time in my life, so worried about America, so worried about the things that my family came to America for, so worried about their respect for rule of law, so worried about respect for institutions, so worried about the fact that, you know, we need to be a united nation. And the things that worry me the most are based on experiences that we have had in my family for three generations. We're not kidding. We've lived it. We've been there. And so the fact that we're so naive about what's transpiring in the country and what could happen to our country if we start losing those rights is very saddening to me, because I don't know how to shake people all up and help them understand how these rights that we've always taken for granted, some of them are slipping away from them and they don't quite get it. That's the world that I live in. It's you know, it's a real frustration.
Thank you for sharing, both of you. I'm sorry, I didn't tell you in advance I was going to ask you that, but it just came up. So thank you for sharing that. Let's talk about inflation to round out the show. I've got a bit of a wind up here, so bear with me. As we all know, the government has been trying to tame the inflation it created by raising the cost of borrowing money. You'll hear this put in terms of the Fed raising rates. Okay, that just means they're raising the cost of borrowing money. I have been really frustrated personally watching the disconnect between what the Biden administration and a lot of left-leaning pundits in the media have been saying about inflation, despite the reality that consumers say they really are suffering. And they are rightly angry about that. Paul Krugman, as recently as January, wrote, "Poor economic sentiment is really just Republicans angry that Donald Trump isn't still president." It's condescending and patronizing, and I don't like it. If you pay attention to this at all, you hear the term CPI thrown around, Consumer Price Index. This is mostly this is the widely used number that is supposed to measure the price of living. Now, consumer sentiment has been negative despite the CPI finally going down. And a lot of people in the Biden orbit and Democratic cheerleaders have been blaming the consumers, where the real problem is that the true impact of inflation has actually been masked by the way CPI is calculated. And in the past, I have aimed some strong language at the CPI because I believe it's a fraudulent tool that misleads consumers, and I stand by that. It used to measure the average cost of a basket of fixed goods over time so that we had a rough idea of how much prices were rising over time. But when they rise sharply and quickly, the government, which can print unlimited amounts of money out of thin air, doesn't look very trustworthy. So the people who measure it in the early 80s started this practice of changing what was in the basket to keep the top line number low. For example, if beef prices spiked and people couldn't afford to buy as much beef as before, and they bought chicken instead, the Bureau of Labor Statistics would stop including beef in the cost of the basket and replace it with chicken. In the early 80s, actually, this was in 1983, to be precise, the year I was born, the government stopped including the cost of borrowing money from this calculation of the cost of living. So all of the interest on mortgages and auto loans and credit cards that have been building over the last 2.5 years are not included in the inflation number you hear about in the news. But ordinary people who are accumulating more credit card debt to continue buying what they need while the value of their dollars has gone down, or can't afford housing because mortgage rates have skyrocketed, or can't buy a car because auto loans are through the roof, are feeling that crunch. And the way we measure inflation accounts for the cost of the car, but doesn't account for what it costs to borrow the money you need to buy the car. So there's a new paper out from three Harvard economists. One of them is Larry Summers. You know his name. One of them is an economist from the IMF. They calculated the CPI using the original, more accurate formula that included these interest costs. And using that calculation, inflation was much higher than the calculation we currently use and that's bandied about in the news media. They show that it peaked at 18% in November of 2022. That's 8 points higher, 7 or 8 points higher than what is reported for that period of time under the standard CPI that's used now. And that consumer sentiment correlated more strongly with the old formula than the new one. So now that unemployment is low and the CPI has fallen, which means inflation is still rising, just less rapidly than it was in 2022, interest rates and borrowing costs are the highest they've ever been in decades. Meaning that, for example, over the course of a 30-year mortgage, you'd pay a lot more than you would if you had bought your house in 2020 or even pre-pandemic. The same is true for revolving credit card debt, which is now higher than it has ever been, over $1 trillion. The Federal Reserve is supposed to be apolitical, and by law, Congress has oversight authority, and the Fed is responsible for manipulating the cost of money, and they do that by raising their benchmark rates, causing all of the other interest rates to rise that we've just been talking about, homes, autos, credit cards. So the takeaway from these Harvard economists, and this is the piece of news that has made the rounds this week, is that lowering interest rates would result in better consumer sentiment and shifting the fundamentals of the election more in Biden's favor. In fact, some people are actually calling for Biden to pressure the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates for exactly that reason, encouraging the President of the United States to attempt to use the Fed and monetary policy for his own political benefit. Biden has, it's worth noting, already pushed the Fed to lower rates at a speech in Philly earlier this month. He said he believes they will lower interest rates. But I want to put it to you both, whether you think it's dangerous for the president to pressure the Fed, and if so, why? And if so, why not?
Well, I'll give you my financial take on it. First of all, there is too much money out in the street, because of COVID, because of other things. And our nation was floating with like $4 trillion. It's now down to $2 trillion. And if you're a consumer economy like we are, you've got to worry about where this is going. And so I, for one, think the Fed is doing a pretty decent job. I think the days of going back to a 2 or 3% mortgage rate is an anomaly. I thought that was a privilege during a few years, but I think a 4% interest rate, 5% interest rate, I'm a former board member of Fannie Mae, so I can tell you historically, our average has been 4.5 to 5% mortgage. And the 3% mortgage was just the fact that there's too much money that needed to go out in the street. I think our nation will do just fine if he's got a 4, 4.5% mortgage. Would I favor the Fed cutting the treasuries down another point? I do. And I hope it does this year. And there's a chance that happens. I will also tell you that, how the world goes, we go. After World War II, we were 80% of the world's GDP. Now we're 21, 22% of the world's GDP, meaning, and our economy is far more global. And so we don't control every single set of circumstances that is created economically. The world plays a big part of that. We import a lot of goods from the world. Those goods are impacted by what's going on in those countries. And so, we suffer as they suffer because we're buying those goods at higher prices. But I think overall, the main reason for inflation is shortage of labor. The labor numbers that you see are not real. We have a real underground economy that employs millions of undocumented immigrants in what? In farming, in hospitality, in the healthcare industry, you name it. You know, if it weren't for those millions of people, our country would be in a real jam. But look at the inflationary things and the consumer price index that you've been looking at. Most of inflation comes from areas where there's a lot of human involvement. Why aren't cars more expensive? Because they have learned to use less humans and more robots. And so those industries have been able to automate or use artificial intelligence or whatever, are much better able to do that. But we have a labor force that's shrinking, that's getting up in age. Those are symptoms of inflation when you have to use a lot of labor force. I think inflation, the number one thing you could do to bring inflation down to the 2%+ that the Fed wants is to have immigration reform, give work permits to millions of people, and solve a lot of different crises at the same time that you're bringing down inflation. But it's become the number one weapon in this election, immigration. And, you know, I don't know how we're going to do immigration reform in the middle of this chaos and thunderstorm. But to me, immigration reform is the number one weapon to combat inflation in America.
Okay. No doubt immigration reform would be huge, economically speaking. I'm mostly concerned about the distance between consumer sentiment and the improving economic indicators like inflation that you just mentioned and unemployment. And why, oh, why? And part of the reason we're talking about this on a political show is because I think that money is probably the most political thing there is in the country. But we never actually talk about tax rates, we talk about what we spend it on, talk about who has how much of it, but we never actually talk about monetary policy and who gets to control how much of it there actually is. And I think that's a shame. I think we do ordinary consumers and people who are consuming news a disservice by not talking about the impact of Fed policy, of monetary policy. And we also politicians don't talk about it either. And when they do, they use a lot of jargon so that they make things sound rosy because they're the ones who stand to lose their jobs if things aren't. And so I don't think that's good. I think we need to have a healthier, more informed conversation about monetary policy and not leave it sort of shrouded in jargon and mystery when it's driving high interest rates or driving high costs of borrowing money. And we know that America is a debt-reliant society. So anyway, the big question here is like, I'll put my cards on the table if you didn't know. I don't think it's a good thing. I don't think it's healthy. I don't think it's good for our institutions, for the president of the United States to be trying to bully the Fed into doing something that's politically good for him. But I think it demands an explanation for why the Fed is supposed to be independent in the first place. So, Hagar, what do you think about this?
So, I was trying to think about this. The Fed is independent. It's always supposed to have been independent. I worked at the Treasury a long time. I worked on the national security side of the Treasury Department, but that independence is something that is supposed to be deeply respected. And by the way, it's not just for the Fed. It goes for a lot of things. For example, there's a reason our courts are supposed to be independent. And yet judges are politically appointed, right? There's always these weird ways or loopholes in which politics enter. There is supposed to be a very deep divide between politics and law enforcement. When I was at the White House, you weren't allowed to ask anybody in law enforcement anything, any kind of favor or anything that could be viewed as a favor, because it was supposed to maintain its independence and you weren't supposed to influence their decision-making or their investigations or whatever it might be. And there are reasons for all of that, right? We live in a system of checks and balances that is a core pillar of a strong democracy. Now, I think you highlight a point, and you've highlighted it before, and I love that you focus on this, because I feel like this is something that is yet another one of those things that is supposed to be independent that not a lot of people shed light on, and that has And that independence is really fraying. And you're seeing it on top of it before our very eyes. It's not like it's hidden, you know? Sometimes with some of the others, it might be hidden sometimes, but this one is in plain sight. And the risk that you have there, if you've got any leader, and this goes for any party, if you have a leader who feels the ability to, feels the freedom to play with monetary policy for political ambition, well, then you can't trust that leader is going to do it with only the better of our society and our economy and our people in mind. They're doing it with a political goal in mind and agenda. And that's risky because that means that it could play in any which way. You have no idea. And it could be done to the detriment of our economy, or maybe it's something that's short term that looks or feels good, but that in the long term we end up paying for very deeply, which is kind of where we're in right now. And I will say the paper by the Harvard economists and Larry Summers, who I have an enormous amount of respect for, by the way, former Treasury Secretary, and it made me feel not crazy, I have to say, because while I believe I see the job numbers from the Biden administration, I see them again, having worked at Treasury, I know what they do to get those numbers.
Agreed.
And so they've got these indicators that the economy is good. Great. I believe you. I have no reason not to believe that. But when you're going out there and you're talking about inflation, sometimes I sit there and I'm like, I don't understand. What CVS do you go to? What supermarket do you go to where the prices haven't increased? Because any person, I don't think you need to be a mom who's going to the supermarket all the time or a pharmacy all the time. I think everybody is attending these locations for services and for purchases. Anybody can tell you that the prices went up and they have not gone down. And listen, some of it could be, a lot of it is probably greed. Without a doubt, I have no doubt that a lot of it is greed. But then how do you get at that, right? If you can't, I think they're struggling with this. They're trying to find a way to change behavior, economic behavior, with playing with the monetary policy and levers. And that is the goal. But you really do have to maintain. That is the Fed's goal too. They have our best interest, or that they are supposed to. And that is why you have a Fed chair. That's, you know, why the appointment of that Fed chair is very long.
And Senate confirmed.
And so, yes, exactly. There's a reason for that. And your job is to defer to them, right? I've appointed the best person. I've chosen the best person. They're qualified. They know that, you know, they know what they need to do. But I do feel like over the last, you know, and I may not analyze this correctly, but maybe I want to say over the last 10 years, but particularly since 2016, the desire to hang on to power by each party, the desire to overlook certain ethics rules or conflicts of interest, or right, like look at the George Santos situation and how long it took to get rid of that guy. The effort to overlook norms and ethics and practices so that administration or party can hold control or gain more control or power is eroding that independence. And you see it in our courts, you see it in law enforcement, and you see it in monetary policy. And you, I really hazard to say, are the only one highlighting that it's infiltrating the monetary policy, but it could have risks. And I don't have off the top of my head, I don't want to like make this up. I don't have hypothetical scenarios that I can think of. We just know as a rule that there's a reason for that independence. There's a reason for those checks and balances. And it's because if you allow political parties or political leaders to take advantage of any of those things I just listed, whether it's the courts, law enforcement, or monetary policy for their own advantage, then it erodes democracy. It you're using something to stay in power, and that's actually fake, and that could hurt us in the long run.
You're using the power of the state to benefit yourself politically. To me, it's a creeping sense of the ends justifying the means, which is exactly the reason that I left the Republican Party in 2016. In 2015, at the end of 2015, after Donald Trump. It's a more subtle version of that. It makes me very uncomfortable. And I don't like the way that people will pile on the moment you say something about inflation, especially the pundits who don't understand monetary policy to begin with. But because it makes Biden look bad or sound bad, then they immediately bristle. And, well, no, you need to look at these numbers instead. Have you read one of these reports? Do you actually know what you're talking about? Most of them don't. Did you bother to watch the Fed's press conference when they said that they are not canceling their plans to cut rates three more times this year, which will loosen monetary policy, but they also updated their inflation forecast to be increasing? So you now have the Fed saying, we see now that inflation is not dead and actually it's rising again, but we are going to cut rates three more times this year. Those two things do not go together. They don't go together.
Exactly.
And there's no explanation for them other than potentially politics. And it's very troubling to me.
And I know you have some good solutions, Ron. I hope that. I hope we'll talk about it in a future weekly roundup.
I actually want to know politicology listeners, I want to know how much of this talk about money interests you. If you're learning about it for the first time, if you are confused by what you read, if you tend to just skip over those sections in the newspaper, or if you just believe what you're told by pundits because it takes too much work to, dig into what the CPI actually means. I'm curious. I would like to hear from you if you'd like to understand this stuff better and just how political it is. I'd like to know that. So send us a note, podcast@politicology.com. I'm serious. I really want to know how you guys think about issues of monetary policy, how much money there is, where it gets sent. And I'm not talking about tax and fiscal policy. I'm talking about, the printing of money and how you distribute it and how you control how much it costs. So now that we are up to speed on some of the biggest stories this week, let's find out what our panel is paying attention to. Hagar, what did you bring?
All right. As you know, I love to talk about things that are happening that are international that are affecting the United States that are a little bit under the radar. So I have two that are kind of merged. I'm going to merge them. One of them is not really under the radar, but matters very deeply, and that's what's happening in Haiti. Haiti, for the longest time, has been one of the most dangerous countries in the world. And a lot of people don't think of it that way because they think of they think of Gaza right now, or they think of the Congo, or they think of Ukraine right now, or so on. Myanmar, perhaps. Sudan, for sure. Haiti has been one of the most dangerous countries in the world for a long time, particularly since their president was assassinated in 2021. Since then, gangs have taken over the country, and there are about 200 gangs. They control most of the country. The last figures were 80% of the capital, but I would hazard to say it's almost all of the capital except for the presidential palace. And it's dissolved this country into just chaos and lawlessness and violence. And it's horrific. And it's gotten especially worse over the last month when the prime minister had gone to Kenya to work out a deal to have a Kenyan security force come to Haiti to get the gangs under control. And because of that, the gangs got angry. They did two major prison outbreaks. You had thousands of inmates break out, and it has caused a significant influx in violence, kidnapping, rape across the country over the last few weeks. And while this is a significant problem, and the biggest problem that I'm going to add to this, aside from the fact that these people are really in danger and people are getting killed and displaced, is that it's going to have a significant impact on migration to the United States. And you're already seeing states like Florida try to brace for that with setting up the National Guard because they're expecting folks to flee by boat and so on. But Haitians also don't go just by boat. They'll go elsewhere. Well, they have to go by boat in general, but they'll go elsewhere across Latin America, and they'll also go to our border. And I've always said that with everything migration related to at the southern border, the U.S. has an interest in helping solve the problems that are causing the migration. And Haiti is a significant problem that is very difficult to get under control. And the reason for that is that it's been ignored as a priority of the U.S. government's foreign policy for a very long time under both administrations. And certainly starting under Obama, because that's when I really paid attention to it, and continued under Trump and has continued under Biden. Right now, the Biden administration is asking for, I believe, $40 billion from Congress that has been on hold to help the situation. Anyway,
is the reason it's been ignored because of corruption issues with the local government? Why has it not been a priority
in Haiti?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's been ignored. It's not as fun to handle for a foreign policy expert because it's such a difficult problem, and it's been, Haiti has had these problems, whether it be corruption related, poverty related, gang related, for a very long time. And there are many reasons for it. Some of it is for sure its own corruption in its own government and its lack of good governance and lack of transparency and weak democracy. Some of it is that France did not exactly set up Haiti very well when Haiti got its independence, and they imposed on them this tax, if you will. That's, a lot of it is reparations or repaying France for land and for a lot of things. But the amount is so high, and if you can believe it, Haiti is still paying off these financial reparations on a yearly basis that are now 200 years old, that have kept Haiti in poverty. New York Times did a huge deep dive into this, and I couldn't believe what I was reading. And France gets very defensive over this. And that has always kind of put Haiti as well in kind of this endless cycle of poverty, which it should not have been. It was the biggest exporter of coffee at one point. I mean, it shouldn't have been in this situation. So you have a mix of both. But when you have a situation where gangs control in this way, the only way to get that under control is what you're seeing happening in El Salvador, which is where you've got somebody go in there who says, I'm going to round everyone up and I'm going to put them in jail, and my police is not going to have any corrupt members, and my police and my army, they're going to get everybody and they're going to get everything under control. And I'm not trying to, I don't want to skim over what's happening in El Salvador as perfect. There are some civil liberties that have been stepped on and so on in order to get things under control security-wise. But it's hard for the U.S. to do that as well for another country. And yet it's our hemisphere. This has a significant impact for us. And so I'm watching Haiti very closely because right now the prime minister has said he'd resign if a new council is created that promises free and fair elections. But the problem is, I think it's very negative news, how they get out of this cycle of gang violence and so on without doing what El Salvador did, which El Salvador only did over the last few years. And then the last thing I'll say, tying it, because I talked about the border and talked about how this will affect migration, is that last week, a Hezbollah terrorist tried to cross into the Texas border through El Paso. Yep, wasn't covered much. If you Google it, you'll see some outlets cover it. A Hezbollah terrorist tried to cross into the border, was apprehended, and when asked what the hell he was doing in the United States or trying to come to the United States for, he said, "I'm a member of Hezbollah, and I came here to, quote, try to make a bomb."
Holy shit.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe I should have said this story first.
Wow.
And so he's been apprehended. Obviously, an investigation has been opened. And FBI Director Christopher Wray said that there has been an increase in individuals on the terrorist watch list trying to get through the southern border. He said in a testimony on Capitol Hill, he was like, but it's small compared to the terrorists who try to get in through other means. And I was like, dude, Director Wray, you are not a calming source for me.
Dude.
So I had to share this story as well because, I mean, Haiti, because this is a really big one and I care very deeply, and you're going to see the effects of this, and you could see spillover. That's how MS-13 grew here. But I had to mention the Hezbollah terrorist story, A, because I hate Hezbollah. I hate those fuckers. But B, because it amplifies in plain sight the threats we face, both from the foreign terrorist threat and border issues. And so, yeah, but this happened. Yeah, if you Google Hezbollah bomb El Paso or Texas, yeah, you'll see Hezbollah guy tried to get through.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know
They
that.
Clearly don't teach them how to lie if they're caught. Amateur.
Yeah, apparently not.
But thankfully, I guess we should be grateful that he was so truthful.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening today. If you have questions about anything we discussed today, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. Whether it's an episode idea, a topic recommendation, or just a simple note about what you thought, we love to hear from you, and we might even use it on an upcoming episode. Also, If you can head over to the Apple Podcast app and rate us 5 stars and leave a review there, we'd really appreciate it. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. I'm Ron Steslow, and I'll see you in the next episode.